once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I said that line twice, but most people couldn't hear it because my microphone was not functional the first time I said it.
Is my microphone turned up like about the same level as yours? Or?
Yeah,
that's better.
See,
okay, good.
It is, but your voice is generally louder than mine, so maybe I should turn you down a little bit that way.
Well, you probably would like to. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and that guy over there is named
Jake.
And this guy over here is named Jeff.
We're both bald. We're both bearded.
And we both named McClure.
Yeah.
And that's not coincidence. It also is not coincidence that we are the two principal advice givers at a firm called the Personal Wealth Coach in Salado, which registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which neither approves nor disapproves and will deny everything. Let's see, what else? What we say on this radio program is not investment advice. It's strictly educational. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their particular, peculiar individual circumstances. And education is given as generally truthful, which brings us to the issue that we do obtain a lot of information that we present on this radio program, and we do get it from sources we consider to be reliable, and we often double check it from other sources to make sure it's real and reliable. So we astutiously, that's the word for the day, astutiously, along with ilk, avoid fake news
as much as is reasonably possible.
And yes. and when we present our opinions, they have nothing whatsoever to do with Town Square Media and vice versa.
When they are shared, we still say they're ours instead of theirs.
Yes, and we don't know what their opinions are.
No.
Which takes us around to the fact that if you have a commercial on this radio program that has, we have not authorized the commercial, nor do we endorse anything that happens on the commercials or anything they claim.
Yeah,
Let's see. For the stock market for the week, we had some really good results. The S&P 500 was up 1.5%. More interestingly, the NASDAQ, which is composed mainly of smaller stocks and tech stocks, hit an all-time record for the week. That's
not too surprising. We've talked about this in the past several months, that smaller companies are the least likely to be impacted by trade war.
And the interesting thing is we had the first two reports on earnings for the second quarter. It was a couple of banks, and J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup.
They both knocked the ball out of the park.
Nice double-digit earnings increases after double-digit earning increases in the first quarter. And normally, except for the tariff wars or the trade wars that are underway, we would have expected to see the stock market breaking records and soaring into unheard of heights.
Yes, because we're breaking records and soaring into unheard of heights in earnings.
Right.
Usually that leads the stock market to do the same.
But the S&P 500 is only up 4.78% so far this year, and we're more than halfway through the year. Which it's not a we're on the way to not a bad year, but the earnings,
a decent year
with earnings up so far this year. The average earnings in the S&P 500 is up around 20%. We're estimating for the first and second quarter together for the year. So the earnings went up 20%, and the stock market goes up 4.78%. Which hides a lot of things.
Market hides things?
In this particular case, there's this tendency since 2009 particularly to look at the S&P 500 as if it is a single investment. And what we're actually seeing is a great deal of diversity, if you will, or different performance.
And people forget the last part of the name, S&P 500. They just call it the S&P, and they forget that the 500 means there's a lot of companies in there.
And so
not always 500, which is a little misleading in itself.
It can't even be narrowed down very conveniently into industries, although some industries are showing a lot of growth and others aren't. For instance, industrial, even though the Dow Jones Industrial Average was also up,
the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not mostly
industrial
anymore.
But the industrial sector of the market is actually down year to date.
On the market side.
And the financial sector is down.
No.
Year to date.
Just hit the industrial side. So manufacturing is down as far as the market is concerned. But for June, the ISM manufacturing index rose to 60.2. Anything above 50 is growth.
Right.
So this is strong growth in manufacturing, and the market isn't reacting
reacting negatively because the market prices for the future, not for the present.
Correct.
And we have a call.
Well, let's finish that one last sentence. And the reason why the market's not reacting positively to this big boom in industrial manufacturing is that there's a lot of uncertainty as to how we're going to sell that in the future with the trade wars.
And the surge in manufacturing, at least some of it, and there's no way at this point of telling exactly how much, is like the surge in exports we'll probably talk about later that we've seen, that we saw in June. There's an awful lot of manufacturing and exporting and importing going on right now to try to get ahead of the tariff. So we're all out of whack.
Yeah, we haven't forgotten about the caller, but this is important. The manufacturing index was at 60.2. So when we look at that and say, hey, what did that grow from? The consensus was 58.5. That's a big difference. But when we dig into some numbers, we'll see some even bigger difference. The supplier deliveries index went from 62, which is major growth, to 68, which is get us this stuff so we can get it out of the country before the tariffs hit.
And there's an awful lot of stuff trying to get into the country before the tariffs hit,
too. Right.
So we do have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Wow. That was a very harsh-sounding voice.
Yes, it was. But what that really boils down to is the market is being driven right now mainly by companies that make stuff here and sell stuff here. And we have a caller again on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. In your newsletter, you mentioned that the – I want to get this straight – the Fed interest rate is still well below the 10-year Treasury.
Well, not well below, but
it's below. Historically, but it's above zero. That's nice.
But you mentioned the inverted yield curve, and that's historically a precursor to a recession in 18 months. Can you go into that a little bit more when you get a chance?
Sure. Right?
Absolutely.
Planning on it, as a matter of fact.
Thank you. That's an excellent question.
That kind of leads into the next thing I was going to say, which is it's a 10-year Treasury note issued by the United States and traded is the prime indicator for interest rates in the United States. Many other interest rates, it's called the federal midterm rate, by the way, come off of that for calculation purposes on loans and so on. And it has been slowly sliding downhill. 2 months ago, it was 3.11%. It closed out at, 2.83 this week. When the interest rates are going downhill on the 10-year note, it is an indication that there is an anticipation of lower loan demand in the future over the next 10 years. It is an indication that we're looking at deflation, which amounts to the same thing. No. Interestingly,
let me jump in here because the caller said something I want to make sure people understand. We do not currently have an inverted yield curve.
Right.
We have a very flat, getting flatter yield curve.
Right. We have about a 25.9 basis points, it's called, which is hundredths of a percent.
2.9 percentage points, right?
No, I'm saying we have about 25 basis points between the 10-year and the 2-year, and that's just where it is measured, and that's something that probably I'll drop into the next newsletter. It's something to be measured because this is the lowest it's been since, get this, late 2006, which was not that far before we had a recession, in 2006, and the yield curve went inverted in 2006, and of course then in 2008 was when the recession officially kicked off. But the point is that the Federal Reserve, which takes us to another thing, we can talk about this some more, and this is an important issue. One of our favorite organizations in the United States government. We have two favorite, at least I have two favorite organizations in the United States government, the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You got to love those places.
We love them because they are unashamedly, unabashedly bureaucrats.
They're
it's
bureaucratic.
In the name.
Right. And I just, it's the two places I'd love to visit. And I have, of course, it would probably burst my bubble because I have this image of a darkened room full of people with green eye shades. And,
right. And pocket protectors and,
pocket
and
protectors
abacuses and, everywhere.
Well, that. And who knows? They might, you know. They're really good at keeping secrets and get really upset if their secret information is let out early. And they've just done a wonderful job over the years of keeping their secrets so they don't get the information out in advance. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports inflation, and they came out with a year-over-year report. In other words, a year ago to today, the Consumer Price Index, all items index, there's lots of CPIs besides just this one, but this is the big one, was up 2.9%, which is the highest it's been up in a long time. It bumped that about 6 years ago for just a little bit and then came back down. But generally speaking, we're looking at the highest inflation we've seen in quite a long period of time. Normally, that causes the 10-year Treasury note to bump upward in interest rates because people are saying, oh boy, we're going to have a bunch of inflation because the economy is overheating and we better ask more money when we loan. We better ask higher interest rates when we're loaning money to the government. But it didn't. Instead of going up, the Treasury interest rates went down.
There's a good reason for that.
Yes.
Do you want me to jump time in
well,
for the
yes,
good reason?
Since you claim to have a good reason,
yeah.
I have a good reason.
There is a lot of new money that's just flushed into the economy from the tax cut.
Yes.
We're looking around
which
saying,
is inflationary.
Right. Where is it going? It's going into banks. It's going into paying down debt.
Share buybacks.
There was a bit of a boost at the beginning of this of some new industrial equipment. Lots of new industrial equipment was getting ordered. Share buybacks have been going on. The companies are buying back their shares. And then there's still this extra money sitting to the side. And when you have extra money sitting in a bank, you want to get a slightly higher interest rate than the bank, but you don't want to give up all of the safety of having a guaranteed position. So the money has to go to a safe place. And it's a little bit scary when we're talking about the market at the moment because we look around and we say, we don't know what the trade war is going to do. So people are pumping money into 10-year treasuries. They're saying this at least, even if it doesn't keep up with inflation, I'm going to get my money back and it's a slightly higher interest rate than the bank.
And it really boils down to the fact that there's a consensus among investors that even though we've had this tremendous increase in corporate earnings, it isn't real.
It's temporary or, well, if it's... I don't think that they would say it's not real.
Well, now
I think what they're saying is that we've just had this boost in earnings. We're having the continued burst in earnings, but it's not something that's a trend line. You can't say next year it's going to happen again. We're not going to have another huge jump in earnings because the earnings this year were based on taxes.
Actually, I can say it's not real. I mean, it really boils down to something simple. The banks that just reported double-digit revenues... Our double-digit increases in profits reported minuscule increases in revenues.
Right.
Which boils down to, hey, you're not doing any more business, but your profits jumped. Why did your profits jump so much? And the answer is, we got a big tax cut, so profits are after taxes. But the problem with the tax cut is it's a one-time deal. So if a company isn't growing its revenues... Then everybody shakes their heads, and there seems to be a consensus, and maybe right or wrong, but there is a consensus out there that down the road, about a year or two from now, the increased interest rates that the Fed is going to have to slap on to control the higher inflation, combined with the tariffs, will negate all the advantages of the tax cut.
Right.
So, but except for one.
Yeah, you can write stuff off forever.
No, no. I mean, there's one big effect to the tax cut that's
a big one.
Well, there's the biggest effect to the tax cut will still be in place. We'll have higher deficits. We'll have trillion-dollar deficits.
Right. There is a boost to earnings that will be there at least through until the next time we change the tax code, which at one point it's in the tax code now to change back in 2025. But between now and then, it might change again if Congress changes it. But this thing where businesses are allowed to write off 100% of many of their equipment purchases, that's a boon that's going to stick around.
Except for one item. And this is what's causing a lot of heartburn, by the way. Turns out that if you've got a building or a factory or an office and you said, goodness gracious, we want to do more business, so let's expand the size of our office building or let's renovate our office to make it more efficient. The tax law missed four words. Qualified business investment property. We're left out in one of the paragraphs. And in the process, that means previously, if, let's say, in our office, we wanted to renovate our office so we could put more people in there or put another room on, add a room onto our office, we would have to depreciate that over 15 years. We could write off what, let's say, it cost us $100,000. Then we would have to divide that $100,000 by 15 and take 1/15 each year as a tax deduction, even though we spent it this year. The intent of the tax law this year that was passed last year was you could write it off immediately. But because they left those four words out of it when they quickly ran it through, now we would have to expense that for tax purposes over 39 years, which means we get to take roughly 1/40.
Yeah, and that is one item. There's some other things in there, too. One piece of this tax code change that I find hilarious, just as a side note. It hit the news big time yesterday because the IRS acknowledged what Congress had written. You know what I'm talking about with the Roth?
Oh, yeah.
There's something called, that's been a workaround.
The backdoor.
The backdoor, the workaround Roth contribution. IRS doesn't like those words. Anytime you say backdoor or workaround, the IRS gets angry. But for good reason. Usually that means that you're interpreting the tax code in the wrong way. Something that's been odd about a Roth IRA for a long time is if you make more money than the allowable amount to put into a Roth IRA, what you have been able to do in this workaround backdoor concept is contribute to an IRA. In many cases, these people were making...
regular IRA.
Right, regular IRA. In many cases, these people were making too much money to contribute to a regular IRA, so it was considered a non-deductible IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And then turning around and converting that 100% to a Roth.
Immediately.
Because there is no income limitation on the conversion to a Roth IRA. And the IRS was... looking at this with
askance.
Yes, askance. The magnifying glasses were out, and the looks of anger and upset were on the faces of the IRS, and they were seriously considering putting this on the chopping block and chopping it into tiny little pieces, and anybody else who had their hand involved in the chopping process would have their hands chopped, too. Well, Congress, in the new law, wrote that it was completely appropriate to do this. Which is very confusing, because if it's completely appropriate to do this, you've just made a very complicated way to contribute to an IRA. So why didn't you just get rid of the income limitation on the Roth IRA? If you're going to say it's okay to contribute to the Roth IRA, that makes sense. But instead, you've got to contribute to a traditional IRA and then turn around and immediately convert it. So you've got to have...
Yeah, but it gives jobs to brokers.
It does. It's multiple account application paperwork. It's multiple transfer paperwork. It's an accounting fiasco because you got to account for the fact that you have a non-deductible IRA that suddenly becomes a Roth IRA. You've got to send to the IRS every time a new IRA is made. The IRS is notified. Every time it's closed, it's notified.
I mean,
if you open and close the thing every year,
think of all those jobs. And think of all the new revenue to the government. See, there's new revenue to the government.
It is job intensive. That's
true.
New
revenue because you're generating paper, right?
Right.
And we've got a 30% tariff on paper, much of which is imported from Canada. So that increases that 30% tariff on all that paper you have to fill out to do two applications as opposed to one. And a third, actually, you wind up with three sets of paperwork. One to apply for the regular IRA, one to transfer to convert it, and one to open the new account. So you got three different sets of paperwork that
you
have to fill out.
Close the original account. Otherwise, you get charged for an
empty
account.
Yeah. And so, you could just leave it open and do this every year.
But if you do that, you get charged by the brokerage firm for having an empty IRA account.
Right. So, just think of all the man hours and all the jobs and all of the paper that comes across the border that we can get a 30% tariff on. It's all a deep conspiracy by Congress and the president to make more money for the government. Not really, but
no, it's not a conspiracy at all. The thing is that it would be fantastic if we could really deeply believe that there was a conspiracy theory here.
3 minute stations.
But the reality is that this is just incompetence. They wrote it too fast.
They left four words out because they did exactly, the Republicans did exactly what they were really angry at the Democrats for doing. With the Obamacare bill, they slam dunk this thing without giving it a lot of consideration and spending a lot of time doing proofreading.
All right. I am going to get out the horrible mirror of truth. You have segued perfectly for me, if you don't mind.
Well, now, we never really hit the issue of I don't think we closed out the issue of the flattening yield curve.
Okay.
We have this 25 basis point spread between the 2-year Treasury and the 10-year Treasury. So the 10-year Treasury is 0.25% higher in interest rate than the 2-year Treasury. And here's the problem, and we mentioned this in the newsletter. If this 3% inflation rate, 2.9%, persists, which we don't know if it will or not, but it might, and then we get what generally economists have said, based on existing tariffs right now, not the extra $400 billion that's supposed to come on later. If we just leave it as it is, then we'll get about a 0.6% increase in inflation simply because the cost of everything we buy goes up. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen because a lot of things can happen between then. But that would put inflation a year from now to 3.5%. The Fed really, really, really likes to keep their short-term interest rates above inflation. Otherwise, why not just borrow lots of money from the Fed and you wind up paying back less money than you borrowed because of high inflation? And they don't like that at all. So if, let's just say, the Fed runs short-term rates up to 3.5% and the 10-year Treasury continues to slide in interest rate that has been sliding even after the inflation report, so we had a 2.8% 10-year Treasury and a short-term Fed rate of 3.6%. That is an inverted yield curve, and that has been followed historically within 18 months by a recession, which is why a lot of economists at this point are saying we're getting closer and closer to a baked-in recession in 2020 generated by two major issues, the tax cut and the tariffs.
And the tax cut led to the boom that is causing the crunch. Booms are good.
Booms, I don't think booms are good, but
well, that's nice to know. If you don't want booms, that's fine. But booms can be.
They scare my dogs.
They scare. Booms are disruptive, but they generally lead to good growth. They also lead to bad growth. If you think of every bubble, you've got bad growth with the good growth. So we've got a boom. We got to recognize that there's going to be bad growth mixed with the good growth.
But we basically are overcharging the economy.
Yeah. So
and you had a subject you wanted to
Yes, I want to do the mirror of truth.
The mirror of truth.
Yes.
Anybody
that listens to this program for very long understands that I have a pet peeve. When one political party complains harshly about mistreatment, and then when they're in power, they go and do exactly the mistreatment that they were complaining about. So in this case, the mistreatment is to the people in power. How's that for you? This is a really weird one. Not the other way around. So, people in power, I'm going to go back in time. Do you have some harp music you can play or something while I do this back in time?
Bum, 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 bum.
Okay, no, that's not very good harp music. I don't know what that was, but it's pretty good, though. I mean, it was an A for effort.
I don't know what back in time music. Do you know?
Dilly-ling, dilly-ling, dilly-ling.
Oh, harp.
Yeah, that's said harp.
I said heart.
Harp. Harp. Yes. So, okay, back in time to January of 2000.
Dilly-ling,
yeah, January of 2009.
Ba-ba-ba-bum.
This, for many people, will cause medical conditions, and other people, it will cause them to go, oh, it's the good old days. So, you'll know where you sit in just a moment. January 2009, then President-elect Barack Obama has a Treasury Secretary nomination. He hasn't nominated him yet because he's not president yet, but he will. He said, this is who I will be nominating. The man in question, Secretary of Treasury, later confirmed, Tim Geithner. If you're a Republican, you remember the angst. This is a man who messed up on his taxes. He did not pay the appropriate taxes on his tax returns for when he worked for the International Monetary Fund. I can hear the rabble rousing starting.
Most people have forgotten this.
No, I still hear this from the hardcore folks that think back and they say this was horrible and that person was still allowed to be the Secretary of Treasury. That's a big deal. They're in charge of the IRS. How could they have not done this?
He was using TurboTax. That was
interesting. He was using TurboTax, and here's the issue. He worked for the IMF in the United States. He had a salaried position with the IMF. The IMF is an international organization that is not based in the United States, so they do not withhold the employer side of taxes. Anybody that's a business owner out there knows that you've got to withhold the employer side of Social Security and Medicare taxes. It amounts to about 7.65% of the salary. The IMF didn't do that. But they gave documents as normal. This is a person that is an employee. And he missed the fact that he had to self-file something called self-employment tax. He's not self-employed. He was employed by someone else as an employee. Well, he missed it, and he missed it for 4 years. 2 years were within the statute of limitations in an audit, so he immediately went, coughed up the money, wrote the check to the IRS. During the hearing process, it was brought up that he missed several years prior to that, so he had to write another check. Now,
he didn't have to. That was voluntary.
It was voluntary if he wanted to be selected as secretary. If he wanted to be appointed and confirmed, he needed to pay the back taxes. Now, the back taxes here, we're talking about just under $60,000 over a four-year period. Total $60,000. Now, I'm going to come forward with just as a side note. Did I mention which newspaper that was?
No.
This was the liberal New York Times.
That's the one who, by the way, broke the news that Tim Geithner had failed to pay his self-employment tax when he wasn't self-employed.
Broke the news and was harshly critical of him. So keep that in mind. Now flip forward to the Republicans who are complaining that the New York Times is only harshly critical of Republicans. That's a funny thing. It makes me laugh. New York Times makes its money by being harshly critical. They may have a liberal bent. No, they do have a liberal bent. But they make their money by being harshly critical of the administration in power.
Whichever one it is.
That's how they sell newspapers. So keep that in mind. Republicans were more likely to buy the New York Times during the Obama administration than during the Trump administration because they were harsh to the Obama administration. Now they're being harsh to the Trump administration. Now I'm going to jump forward to a conservative media outlet, Forbes. Forbes broke the news about Wilbur Ross not selling his publicly held assets, which is a massive ethics violation. He wrote a statement to the ethics board saying he was going to divest himself of these assets, and he didn't do it. Forbes, a conservative news organization, came out and said, hey, you can't do that. The ethics accounting office sent a letter to Wilbur Ross saying, you may be in violation of criminal and civil law. You need to sell this stuff. Forbes, just as a side note, was angry at Wilbur Ross already. The anger, I think we talked about this yesterday, the anger was because Forbes pegged Wilbur Ross with a net worth around $2.5 billion.
Because Wilbur Ross said he had $2.5
billion. Right, because when he was interviewed by Forbes to say what assets he had, this was in 2016, he said he had $2.5 billion. He provided paperwork. Now, the paperwork is all based on his signature, but he provided the paperwork to Forbes saying this is what he was worth. So Forbes used that in their richest people thing, their list of billionaires. Wilbur Ross was on the list. Come forward to the end of 2016 and now into 2017. He's nominated. He's going through the confirmation process. He fills out paperwork for the government saying his net worth is $700 million or less. Still a very large fortune, don't get me wrong. But Forbes gets upset when they get lied to. So Forbes latched on to that. They said, you lied to us. You told us you had $2.5 billion. We verified it with documents you provided. And now we're looking at documents you're providing to the government, and they're different documents.
Well, either one of two things is true. Either he was lying to the government,
or he was lying to Forbes.
Or he's lying to Forbes.
So there was a lie here. So Forbes is chasing it down. Where's the lie? This is very much like what the New York Times did to Tim Geithner, because they didn't like that there was a libertarian being nominated by a Democrat. Tim Geithner was a libertarian. Come forward, there's a Democrat, Wilbur Ross, being nominated by a Republican. Well, Forbes doesn't like that either. So Wilbur Ross was a Democrat all the way up to the Trump election. He is now Secretary of Commerce. He's one of the major pushers for the trade war. And he held assets that he claimed he didn't remember holding.
Oh, yeah.
This is the same
company he founded.
Well, the company he founded was purchased by Invesco. He owned lots of shares in Invesco as part of the purchase of the company that he founded, and he didn't sell it. And parts of that he put into a trust for his family, but he still knew what was in the trust. So this is something that we have to be very clear on for ethics purposes. If you're in a position like Secretary of Commerce, you have access to all kinds of non-public information. You can move the markets, and he does with the trade tariffs. Markets are moving. It's very clear that he could very easily put himself into a criminal situation without meaning to if he doesn't work on this quickly.
Now, didn't he do some short sales?
He
in
did.
His portfolio just before the tariffs were announced?
Over a four-month period, he was doing short sales. And his response to the letter was to say, I was doing these short sales to divest myself of these assets.
No.
You don't do short sales over a four-month period to divest yourself of your assets if you're already Secretary of Commerce. You needed to get rid of them before you were Secretary of Commerce. Well, and I've got to say, you have the possibility of losing money by dumping them that fast, but that's still the rules. If you're going to be in public service, it's service. So I'm bringing this up because we were hard on Martha Stewart. She used to be a stockbroker. She knew better. Insider trading is a real thing, and she knew the rules. She lied to the FBI about it. She knew the rules about that, too.
Ah, the Commerce Secretary probably doesn't know the rules.
That's the thing. If you know the rules, if you're in charge of a financial institution for a long period of time, and you've got the chops to be Commerce Secretary, and he does, follow the rules, dude.
And it seems to me like, and I don't know if he'll do this, if he were to be equated with Tim Geithner, then he would take the gains he made on those short sales, which incidentally were in companies that suffered because of the tariffs that
right.
he knew were coming.
And he made some big gains.
The rest of us didn't
there.
Know were coming.
Big gains.
Several hundred thousand dollars. I think it was 600,000 or something, 700,000.
Now compare that to the 60,000 of Geithner. There's been some inflation.
If he's going to be completely straightforward, then he will write a check to the government or to
somebody, a charity, even.
For the amount of money that he made by doing short sales in areas that were negatively affected by tariffs that he knew were coming when he did the short sales.
Now let me be extra clear here. Just like with Tim Geithner, I think there was no conspiracy to defraud the government here. I think that he was incredibly impressed and wanted to take over and do a good job as Secretary of Commerce, and he didn't manage his affairs well right. In the transition partner process. He went from private enterprise, where the rules are completely different, to government enterprise, and one of the things that as investment advisors and help for our clients, we've helped them with the governmental forms, which are a pain in the rear. Those forms are reams of data to fill out on your personal holdings when you're in government service at a high enough level.
I am of the opinion, for whatever it's worth, that what happened there was whoever he had managing his money, he didn't give him a deadline to get unload that sources.
Right.
He just said, unload them, but don't kill me with taxes and losses in doing so.
And they may have been trying to protect him in the process.
They were trying to do some sophisticated maneuvering to get him out of those positions without taking a big hit.
And, right, but the reality is they didn't get the correct instructions. Just like Tim Geithner doing his own taxes, probably not a good idea at that level. You should have hired somebody else. You got to recognize mm-hmm. the tax code's too complicated. In this case, if you cannot give clear directives to the people that are managing your money, then you need to get on it quickly.
Or he could have held them off from doing so. Who knows? No, and nobody probably ever will know. The point is, I think it's just 2 cents worth, not that it'll ever happen, that Congress should pass a law saying if somebody is confirmed as a secretary and is required to divest themselves of their assets,
uh-huh.
that they be enabled to have a special treatment for taxes or whatever.
Right, so that if you dump your assets and suddenly you're in the massive tax bracket because you had to dump your assets mm-hmm. and you've got this big gain, you should get a better tax treatment on that because it's not your choice.
One of the things I am very well convinced of is that Wilbur Ross and every other secretary at the cabinet level took a big pay hit.
Oh yeah,
to become to go into government service because he's probably making millions of dollars a year to making a couple $100,000 a year, and I think Congress should pass a law
recognizing that service.
Recognizing that we're going to require you to either pass a law allowing them to put them in a blind trust with no hassle. Automatic blind trust or pass a law that says you're not going to be subject to the taxes.
This, though, is clear if we're talking about immigration and you're anti-amnesty on immigration. The law is clear currently. We shouldn't be anti-amnesty, or we should be anti-amnesty here as well. He needs to cough up some money to somebody to say, hey, this was wrong. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Go ahead. You're on the Personal Wealth Coach.
Okay. This is your nemesis from Malham County.
All right.
And I'd like to hear you guys talk about two things.
Are you a nemesis?
He's a nemesis.
You're a nemesis or a nemesis?
There you go. You got it.
All right.
I heard both of y'all say the right word.
All right.
Nemesis.
Right. Got it.
Okay. Let's play the nemesis music.
Dum, 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 dum.
All right. Here you go. Go ahead.
I want you to talk about two things.
Sure.
And I've heard, y'all have beat this dead horse to death about what's going on at the...
Was it dead before we started beating, or did we beat it to death first?
Which dead horse?
I think y'all beat it to death first. But I wanted to change and get on something else. This immigration deal,
mm-hmm.
I love our country. And we couldn't make it without immigrants. But we've got to pass something that really fits everybody.
You're not the nemesis here. We are
in total agreement.
We're in complete agreement on that.
But I don't know. I don't know how you fix this. And that's what I want y'all to talk about. And then the other thing.
We've talked about that. We'd be glad to.
Yeah, well, there is a solution, and it's a pretty clear one. So we can talk about that.
The other one is Trump's you know, he put a little tariff on everybody.
Yeah.
I really don't think any of that's going to be there in 2 years. That's my point of view, is, and I want to see what you guys think about it, because he is a negotiator, and that's what he's trying to do.
Okay. We'll see. This is the thing.
I want y'all to tell me what.
Let me address that on the negotiation. The negotiations with China have been called off. There are no negotiations going on with China at this point. The Trump administration called off the negotiations, and the point is that this is. I completely agree with you. He wants China to back down. He wants Europe to back down. I'm not sure what he wants Canada to do. I'm not sure how Canada could back down when we have a trade surplus with Canada and we're putting high import taxes, high tariffs on stuff that we need to import from Canada.
Soft pulp lumber and
I think it's a personal thing.
Steel.
But I don't know. But
I do too.
The point is that somebody's going to lose face here. And the Chinese are not real good about losing face. And neither is Donald Trump. So once the tariffs go into place, I personally think they'll still be there when the next president is elected.
Here's the thing that is my statement on it. I was willing to take at the beginning that this could be a negotiation tactic and he'll back down. And a lot of economists were. I mean, we went to several conferences of economists that it was almost unanimous. We believe this is a negotiation tactic. We don't believe he's going to impose any of the tariffs. We'll now come forward to today. That was a month ago. And looking at today, we've got, let me count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 11 tariffs that have been imposed that are not in negotiation. We've got India is about to put they're the next one scheduled to put a tariff on anybody, and that will be August 4th. They're going to retaliate for one of our tariffs on them. They're going to put a tariff on $241 million worth of apples, steel, and other products.
And
the biggest thing that I have to say here is that if this is negotiation, then we should expect to see actual negotiation. And we're not. There's not a dialogue. It's just this is what we're doing.
And the Chinese, for example, we were the biggest soybean exporters in the world. And now we have a lot of soybeans and nobody to sell them to. And the Chinese are not buying them. And they are, though, they have just let some contracts with Brazil and several other places in South America to expand their soybean production. This is a multi-year investment to find a replacement for soybeans, which means the Chinese are looking at the import duty they put on soybeans, and they expect it to remain in place for 10 years.
The subject we were on, the dead horse conversation of Wilbur Ross. Wilbur Ross, before he became Secretary of Commerce, has for years talked about instituting tariffs as a normal way of doing business with the government. So when you have the Secretary of Commerce who has the ear of the president is taking his advice and actually doing these tariffs. We know what his advice has been, what his statements have been about tariffs in the past, and it isn't a negotiate with somebody issue. It's a we're going to institute these to correct an imbalance, not to negotiate an imbalance correction, but to just levy tariffs. So that's where we are today. It could still be a negotiation.
Yeah,
I would be equally surprised either way, which is to say I don't have a clue what the long-term plan is. And we've got to play some commercials. We're going to come back with the immigration thing.
Okay. I'm going to hang up so I can listen to y'all on the radio. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. Right.
Thanks for the call. Good call. And you're not our nemesis.
All right, so we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. We have about 7 minutes left in this first hour, and then we have another hour.
But I wanted to address the first part of the question from the last nemesis caller.
Okay.
Immigration.
Okay,
we have talked about this in the past. So before we begin what the solution is, let's talk about the problem. We have people coming across the border without being documented, without being tracked. Some of them are bad people. Some of them are not bad people. They're coming across, and it's a problem. So we got to understand, everybody's got to understand, this is a problem. If we have a law that says it's not legal, then we should either change that law. We're not doing that yet. Or we should say, all right, this is not legal. We got to figure out some way of fixing it. So there's a problem. You can call it an invasion. I've heard that word used because it is massive. There's a large number of people coming. I prefer to call it the long-term traditional instead of calling it in the sense that we could, I'm going to call it an immigration wave. Okay, statistically, that's what these things are called.
Yeah.
It's an immigration wave. We had immigration waves from Eastern Europe. We had immigration waves from Ireland and Scotland. We've had immigration waves from Germany. We are now having an immigration wave from South America. Is it legal or illegal? Both. We've got legal immigration and illegal immigration, just like we did during each of the other immigration waves. So at those times, they were also called invasions. That does not make this one okay. It doesn't make those ones okay. It doesn't make it bad either. You've got to take those out and say, okay, this is happening. In order for us to look at society and say, this is the way things should happen, we have to look at what are we trying to preserve and what are the needs that are not being met that are allowing this immigration wave. So what are we trying to preserve? Well, I think that the common thread that I've heard there is a cultural preservation. It's a little bit strange because we're a melting pot, and eventually when people come here, they get assimilated and they bring parts of their culture with them. What the scare is, what the fear is that instead of melting into our pot, they hold themselves separate and don't melt with us. Their culture becomes more and more strong so that we eventually have two languages as the official and then maybe replaced by another language as the official. Just as a side note, that's not going to happen. I understand that that's the fear. Okay, so every other immigration wave we've had has been just as lumpy, if you will. The reason why we have little Italies in Chicago and New York and San Francisco and Chinatowns spread around the country as well is because the first generation of an immigration wave does not assimilate. They don't even know how to assimilate. It's their children that assimilate, but they leave vestiges. So we've got little Italy, but I've got an even better one for you because it's clear, it's near to us here in Central Texas, Fredericksburg. That was part of a German immigration wave for King Frederick. They even named the town after a king that wasn't a United States king. It was a German king. He came and visited the place. Was that a legal or illegal immigration wave? Both, just like this one. Okay, so what is the solution then and now? It didn't get used then. We didn't have the technology to use it then. We're trying to preserve a culture. We're trying to say there are certain aspects of our culture that we don't want to change. We want ethics, freedom. We want the ability to do good business. There's a whole series of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There's a lot of things that we can look at and say, these are American values that we do not want tarnished. So how do we accept the fact that the immigration waves, all of them throughout history, have been funded by the people who are anti-immigration? Because they're the ones that are paying the people to come here to accept jobs. They're also funded by everybody else that's here in the United States. It's basically, if you live in the United States, you are funding immigration, whether that's because you live in a house that was built with some illegal alien construction effort, or you have gone to restaurants or hotels or eaten chicken, or it's uncountable places where the illegal side has touched things that we use, all of us. What you do is you track that and you say, if you're an employer, use E-Verify. We want to tax them. We want to track when they come to the employment. And then when they're done with employment, we need to track them going back home. And that's something we can do, but it means that we have to open up the border a little bit to do it while closing the border to the illegals. So it is something that is reasonable. The question isn't, people agree on this, by the way, the question isn't whether or not we should do it this way. It's what we should do to the people that are already here. And that's the hang up, but that's where amnesty comes in and people get upset.
The issue with dealing with all this, by the way, one of major issues, something, nobody knows the exact numbers, but something in the vicinity of half of the people who are in the United States illegally are not criminals. They it's a strictly civil issue. They entered the United States perfectly legally, and they just overstayed whatever legal entry method, which makes it a civil offense, which means you can't arrest them. You can sue them, but you can't arrest them. So if we were to close, put the ball up and completely close illegal crossings of the border, probably would cut illegal immigration by 40%.
Yeah, but it would still be there, because that's not the majority of where the illegals cross, because they don't come across illegally. They stay illegally. We're about out of time. We're out of time this hour. If you'd like to contact us off the air locally, the number is
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.